Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio program. My name is Keith Pannell. I'm here with co-host Russ Chianelli. And today we have a guest that's going to talk about clouds. So, Russ, who's our guest?
Here to tell us about clouds on Science Studio is Dr. Sarah Brooks, and she's from the Department of Atmospheric Science at the Texas A&M University. Welcome, Sarah, to Science Studio.
Thank you very much.
Well, this is great. Now, before we get into clouds and your interest, how did you get into science? When you were a little girl or when you were a young woman, I don't know. How did you decide science was the thing that you wanted to do?
Oh, science. Well, okay. When I was a little girl, I was very curious. But science came to me as a total accident, I'm afraid. There were summer programs, and there was a summer program from the high school in the Governor School of Science and in Pennsylvania and the Pennsylvania Governor School of the Arts. And I tried to go for creative writing. And I got partway through. So you had to go and have an interview and write a story. And I think that my story had a murder in it and it was too gruesome. And so I wasn't invited to go.
Too creative.
Yeah, too creative. And so now I'm stuck. I was allowed to go to the science one.
So that's very nice. Now, this is a high school?
That was in high school, yes.
Okay. I mean, but so this was a high school dedicated to just science or a summer program?
Oh, summer program. It was exciting. It was 5 weeks at Carnegie Mellon, and you were like like being a college student. And
you know, I had a similar experience with creative writing, which I won't bother the fans or the audience with now. But did you ever regret that? Do you ever think about going back to creative writing?
I thought about going to science journalism. I think that would be an excellent career for someone who's a little more creative and a little less morbid than I am, I guess.
So anyway, you then science was it. So what branch of science particularly entertained you? Did you like cutting up dead rabbits and the biological sciences, or are you more into the more quantitative areas?
Well, I did really love chemistry, actually, because of how I think it's very elegant and you can trace one molecule and where it's going and what it's going to connect to. So I have a degree in chemistry, and then I worked for DuPont. So I did central research and development in Wilmington, Delaware, and I was making precursors for catalysts for the ultimate goal of making better spandex. And so that chemically, I thought that was really cool. I really enjoyed doing the metal oxide chemistry, but I didn't think that stronger, faster spandex was really my calling. And so I sort of moved.
Where did you go to school? Before you got there, where did you go to school? Where did you study?
Oh, so I went to MIT, and I got a bachelor's degree in chemistry.
Okay, and then went on for a PhD in Colorado somewhere?
Yes, then I thought it was going to have to be more about the planet and the environment, and so off I went to the University of Colorado in Boulder. And I was in the chemistry department there. So I was an analytical chemist working for Maggie Tolbert, who specializes in clouds. And at that time, some of the most important things to think about were polar stratospheric clouds and the ozone hole. And so we focused on what it takes to be a polar stratospheric cloud.
Okay, well, tell us a little bit about clouds. How do clouds form? Okay, we know you've got to have moisture in the environment, you've got to have a certain humidity, but what makes the cloud suddenly form and then dissipate? Because you can go out there, and we do it here in West Texas a lot, you watch a cloud and then it slowly dissipates.
Right.
Tell us from the point of view, as you understand clouds, what makes them form, what makes them dissipate?
Well, the piece of a cloud formation that most people don't think about is that even in a natural situation, you need a seed, or what we call a cloud nuclei. Otherwise, to get yourself an absolutely pure water droplet, you would actually need a relative humidity of, say, 106% or to 110%, and that's just too much for the atmosphere. And so all these clouds actually form on seeds, and those seeds are small aerosol particles, tiny liquid droplets or dry particles made of various dust, background sulfates, sea salt from the ocean, things that have formed in the atmosphere from gases condensing to become particles. So first you have to get the conversion from a dry aerosol particle to a cloud droplet. But cloud droplets aren't big enough to precipitate in rain. And so there's a competition between. You get a cloud is basically a bunch of adolescent droplets that are very small, and might just stay based on the temperature and saturation in equilibrium and not get any bigger. So to actually get to where they're going to fall out of the sky, they have to grow larger by colliding with one another. And then they start to collide, they coalesce, you've got two become one, and then they get to where they have bigger settling velocities than the rest of the droplets.
So I can understand the whole concept of seeding with dust or seeding with other materials, but you use this concept of a dry aerosol droplet. So why don't you tell the audience, and also Russ and I, what is a dry aerosol droplet? What is an aerosol?
An aerosol is a tiny particle in the atmosphere, suspended, and maybe I misspoke. It can be either a liquid droplet, something soluble that goes into solution, has a little water with it, or it can be something completely dry, like a dust particle from desert dust, or a carbonaceous particle from the back of a diesel truck or biomass burning or a forest fire. All of those classify as aerosol particles, and there are hundreds of types of aerosol particles out there.
It sounds like there's also a lot of physics involved here, right? The size of the particle, the surface tension, when a particle would actually fall as a raindrop, and so on. It sounds like a fairly complicated problem.
Yeah, the basic theory has two components for when an aerosol will become a cloud, what we call a cloud condensation nuclei, or like that initial droplet. And there are two competing effects. There's size, which has curvature and gives you the surface tension effect, and then there's solubility. And so various compositions of aerosols will be able to form clouds at different supersaturations based on their solubility.
So then not all aerosols are equally effective as creating clouds.
Absolutely not. There's a huge range.
If you were into the process of seeding, we read that in past generations people have tried to seed clouds, and I understand in the Middle East they still do sort of experiments to cloud seed or seed clouds. What would be a good candidate for seeding for clouds, and what would be a bad one? How would you differentiate?
The main way to do cloud seeding is still to get the ice particles, because once you have ice, and that's another thing.
Hail.
Well, hail is something that can happen with ice, but in any thunderhead, you actually have some ice in the updraft. And so ice is very helpful if you want it to precipitate, if your goal is to be a cloud seeder, because once ice nucleates, once you have an initial ice crystal, it'll grow very rapidly. So if you'd like to have an ice crystal, then something with the same crystal lattice structure as ice would be a perfect seed to try cloud seeding. So silver iodide is still used.
Sounds expensive.
Yeah, well, clouds are precious, you know. In some places, for instance, in Saudi Arabia, in Qatar, cloud seeding operations are attempting to
You sound skeptical, but I always thought it would work under certain circumstances.
I'm skeptical about cloud seeding because it's something that's done operationally. In other words, a lot of, non-scientific operations go out and give a try at cloud seeding. And in fact, it might work, but it's really difficult to confirm whether it's worked or not. I mean, how do you do a statistical experiment? I mean, the beauty of clouds.
Oh, I see. So you seed and it rains or it doesn't rain, but you really don't know why.
Yeah. You know, was the cloud tall enough or at a high enough altitude? Was the cloud moist enough? Was the cloud about to rain anyway? And you can never go back to the same cloud. And so it's very difficult.
Interesting. Yeah. Okay.
Sounds like a stimulus package. I mean, something happens, but you don't quite know what the direct cause and effect.
Yeah.
But people still do it. I mean, you mentioned the Middle East. I mean, clearly that's a place which is particularly needful of water. But
yeah, I'm surprised they have any clouds at all.
Yes. In fact, they have very few clouds. What they're doing at this time is feasibility studies to see if cloud seeding would actually really work. And
we'll have to see.
It's not too promising.
Well, yeah, but I mean, okay, so you suddenly get a bunch of clouds, but then you get a wind, and Qatar is not a very big place. So it blows away to some other neighboring country. So the trick is to seed it somewhere. So it's going to come towards you.
Well, it's a risky business.
But what Sarah has told us then is that
the conventional Native American rain dance is just as effective as seeding, because it might rain. or it might not.
What is it that your current research is involved in?
My current research, you could say, is actually studying the inadvertent weather modification. In other words, as we put pollution into the atmosphere, what does that do to cloud formation? So I'm actually interested in all forms of aerosol particles and their various compositions, particularly interested in soot and burning particles and how they, or under what conditions they can be a cloud nuclei.
Well, in fact, I mean, in many parts of the world, including North America and Europe, at the end of the growing season, when there's a stubble left in the field, people tend to burn that, all right? Mm-hmm. And so this would be a good place for you to go and study the impact of the burning in an area where they do it and in another area where they do not with similar climate?
Well, you could study where burning is done and where it isn't done, but right. The reality is that transport of particles is enormous. And so, for instance, we did a study in Barrow, Alaska. We were measuring cloud nucleation from an aircraft on the northern tip of Alaska. And on many days, there were very few cloud nuclei. But in fact, there was burning in Siberia that brought soot particles into Alaska. And we saw enormous differences in the cloud's properties based on that. So as a rule of thumb, aerosol particles are transported all around the northern hemisphere in 1 to 2 weeks. So you get extreme mixing, something we don't realize. Okay. We really
are. And so seeding, in that case, I mean, I tend to think, that seeding would be almost immediate, right? I mean, if you're going to throw up silver iodide or dust or soot, you know, then it's there, but it's not going to be there tomorrow. And so the seeding has to be quite rapid.
If you have an excellent nuclei, it'll be rapid. If it's not so great, or if the temperature and saturation aren't conducive to that, particles would remain longer and the seeding could happen later.
You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. I'm here with co-host Russ Chinelli and Sarah Brooks from Texas A&M, and she's an expert on clouds. We'll be back.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. David Neisel.
And I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog. In Shakespeare's play, Richard III is a clever, ruthless murderer obsessed with ascending to the throne of England. But history books paint a much more balanced picture of a king who brought reforms.
What we didn't know until now was the location of his dead body. Richard III was killed in battle against supporters of Edward V, whom he was central in having dethroned in order to claim the crown in 1483.
Just 1 year later, during the battle on Bosworth Field, Richard was surrounded and killed. Here, the story gets murky, with some accounts of his body being thrown into a river and others suggesting a quick and unkingly burial in Leicester.
Cut now to 2012, to a team interested in finding Richard's remains. Using historical accounts that he may have been buried at the Church of the Grey Friars, they keyed in on a parking lot.
Next, they used ground-penetrating radar in the area where the ancient church choir would have been and found human remains. A skeleton clearly shows a man who suffered from a curved spine called scoliosis, which Richard did.
Plus, wounds on the skull match descriptions of the king being struck during a cavalry charge that pushed the helmet into his skull. It's also possible he lost his helmet and was struck in the back of the head.
The comparison of mitochondrial DNA, which is always inherited from the mother, to a modern descendant of the king also proved to be a match, leaving little doubt the remains belong to King Richard III.
What's interesting is a 3D mapping of the skull is being done to give us a first forensic reconstruction of how he appeared when he died at the age of 32. And now, after all these years, there are plans to give the king a proper burial.
We are Drs. David Neisel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Ross Chinelli, Sarah Brooks from Texas A&M, and she's an expert on clouds. So we were talking about various methodologies of seeding. And Sarah, you mentioned that in Alaska you were doing studies, and then you had all this sort of dust material coming out from Siberia, which, if I'm allowed to make a story here, I once flew across, I guess I was going to China, but I was across and I woke up in the morning and I was over Siberia. And I looked down and I thought, my God, we're going to crash because we were so low. But it wasn't that we were so low. It was that the air was so clean that everything looked much more magnified and closer. And so the idea that there is still pollution coming out of Siberia is sort of interesting because I thought it was rather a pristine location.
Let me ask you another question. I think it's in this topic of clouds and so on. I think it's obvious to many of us that actually water vapor and clouds are the main greenhouse gas, if you will, that control the temperature of the Earth. Can you talk a little bit about that? I mean, we have more clouds, the Earth is cooler.
Well, in fact, there are some that say that water vapor is the main greenhouse gas, but CO2 is an enormous greenhouse gas.
Yeah, but there's so much more water in the atmosphere than CO2. And there was even some studies that I showed that actually say, well, if you really want to cool it, let's make some more soot and create more clouds. Or the other thing that happens to clouds, we have SO2 aerosols, you know, from sulfur burning and so on. I know that it's a controversial subject, but I think everybody ignores the fact that water vapor is the dominant greenhouse gas by far because of the quantity.
The first thing to think about when you're talking about greenhouse gases is just to take a step back and realize that not all greenhouse gases are anthropogenic or are induced by humans, right? But actually, there's a delicate balance. It's called the radiative balance from incoming sunlight and the light that some light will be absorbed by clouds, by particles. Some will be absorbed by the Earth itself, and then all those can eventually leave. So you get a blanketed temperature of the Earth. This greenhouse gas is a blanket. That is actually very important. If we didn't have the natural greenhouse gases, if we had no human activities and we had just the natural greenhouse gases, the temperature of the Earth would be
much higher.
No, it would be 30 degrees colder. It would be uninhabitable. So to say that we have CO2 and water as the major greenhouse gases is true, but what we're really interested in the climate debate is how are we perturbing that balance? And the fact that we're adding additional CO2 that we've taken from fossil fuels and thrown into the atmosphere at a faster rate than sort of intended is increasing the greenhouse gases.
But as you said, the soot also creates more clouds, and that would cool.
Okay, so that is true. There are definitely things that increase the radiative balance and decrease the radiative balance. And clouds are an important topic on that case. If you have a high cloud high up in the atmosphere, say an ice cloud that's up in the stratosphere, then its primary interaction is with sunlight to scatter the incoming sunlight. Now, if you have a lower cloud, its primary role in the atmosphere is actually to absorb some of the light that's being re-radiated off the Earth and warm. So, in fact, aerosols and clouds have both warming and cooling effects.
Well, Russ, you just got a C- in cloud formation and global warming.
Keith, I'm not going to take that lying down. I think that actually this point that's been made here is that there's very little science in the subject. Everybody wants to concentrate on bad first world nations creating CO2. Another program that'll be on.
So the way that I think about this, it's no surprise I disagree with you, but the basic idea that human activities have an impact on climate. Well, number one, the climate's warming. That we have a good record of. The climate is warming. Now you could say, well, there are natural cycles as well as human-induced cycles. So is it just the natural cycles? And it really, if you look at temperature reconstructions, like, no, it's not just the natural cycle. So we are warming. Virtually certain, and when we say virtually certain, that's 99% certain that the temperature is warming. And then we're also 99% certain that human activities have a role in that. Now, but you hear a lot of things about climate change. So do we, for instance, get more hurricanes because of climate change? And then the certainty on that is drastically dropped. That's maybe 30% certain, like that perhaps there's a trend towards category 4 and 5 hurricanes. So, in fact, we don't know if there's going to be more hurricanes at all, but they could be intensified hurricanes.
So that's where the science is yet not really concluded.
If you take each aspect of climate change, there are actually only a couple that the non-skeptics think are solidified. And then there are many, many aspects that have, like, are we going to weaken the conveyor belt in the Atlantic Ocean and change circulation? are we going to weaken it? I believe that's like a 30%, yes. Are we going to really weaken it to the point that the salinity changes are significant and we shut it down? That's like a 2%. So that's like something that could possibly happen. So the IPCC has given the international or the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change has delineated what they really know.
They also predicted that the glaciers were going to be gone in 2030 in Tibet, and they've retracted that.
Let's get back to this, because it's an important thing, and Russ is appropriate to be a total skeptic, but. We'll do another program.
But there's
on that.
No 99% certainty on glaciers either. That would fall down in the somewhere in the lesser.
Maybe this is it. But the logical conclusion, if that's all correct, is population. There's too many people in the planet. If we talk about that, then we can have an agreement. Because you might want everything to melt so we can grow more farms and get more water.
Let's go back to you're in Alaska. You're sampling up there, and you're doing that from airplanes. And so one of the key features of your type of research is that, not all locations are the same. So you must be doing a lot of traveling to sample different air qualities and study them in different locations. What do you learn from that geographic distribution of your sampling?
So we can do that one of two ways. In Alaska, many different air masses come through Alaska. And so what we do are called back trajectories or other figure out where the air masses have come from and compare that to the very different sorts of sampling we see. But another approach is we went to Punta Arenas, Chile, and we put our instrumentation on a ship and moved very slowly from Chile all the way to Seattle, Washington.
And you were on the ship?
Yes. My postdoc and I were on the ship.
How long
doing
did that
this.
Take?
30 days.
That took 30 days. That took a very long time. So that's the advantage of that kind of measurement is that we could then say we get a full sample of what is it like coastal and what is it like in the open ocean. And so what are the conditions like in the northern hemisphere versus the southern hemisphere? We are hitting different seasons, so you could start in the fall and go for springtime. And so those are the questions we sort of ask. What are the differences regionally? What are the differences if you have, for instance, by the coast, you have maybe 2,000 to 5,000 particles per cubic centimeter. So lots and lots of particles, and all of those are candidates to be cloud nuclei. And we got to the far out in the Pacific, and we had 130 particles per cubic centimeter. So you're a fraction, a tenth of the particles.
When you do this study, then tell us how big of a sample do you have to take?
We get a full story.
You pump through... and trap the particles on filters, and so you know exactly what volume of air you've pumped through into the process or what? How do you do it?
Well, we actually use filters to bring back and do the chemistry of the aerosols at home, which we do with Raman spectroscopy. But to see if they are cloud droplets or not, we have an in-situ cloud chamber. And so particles are sucked into the chamber, and they experience one condition. In other words, ambient temperature and 1% supersaturation. And that measurement takes about 5 minutes. And what we want to do is step through a series of supersaturations. In other words, say at this temperature, how much moisture is it going to take for these ambient particles, the local particles, to become cloud droplets?
So it means that you've got more water in the atmosphere than should be there for that temperature. And so anything you add is probably going to cause it to cloud form.
Well, as we step through the supersaturations, yes, we can hit a high enough one that anything could be, that it could be a nuclei.
Right.
So, but what we get from that series of supersaturations, we call that a cloud droplet spectrum. And we pick the critical supersaturation where 50% of the particles could activate.
Okay.
And you can do that every 30 minutes. So every 30 minutes, you know if the local particles, what moisture it takes for the local particles to make a cloud.
So the filters that you bring back from your trips, you can get the particles back off easily from the filter.
Well, we actually have a Raman microscope or a Raman spectrometer attached to a microscope.
Right.
We don't take them off the filters, but we walk across the filters and measure their composition as we go.
You see, I'm just trying to find out how you put the particles in the precise concentrations that you found down in the...
Oh, I see. Pacific. Okay. So I'm not making that clear. That's another type of experiment. So, you know, when you're on ship, you're just sampling the CCM spectrum of everything that's out there. And for instance, you can easily go through a polluted plume if you're sitting in Punta Arenas and it's a polluted day. There's actually a lot of industry there. You have many soot particles are coming in. But really what you're getting is the cloud forming ability of that whole population. So then the filter is to see, oh, well, what was there at that time? But then if you are a chemist and you want to know exactly, you know, is it the soot particles or is it soot particles mixed with other pollution and they've got acid, sulfuric acid on top of them now or so forth, these minuscule details, then we take the same cloud chamber and in our laboratory we generate particles of known compositions, and we burn soot particles, send them through a coating oven where they get a certain amount of acid coating, and then say, okay, are these were we really right? So that's the confirmation. Okay. Like, were these the particles that made the clouds?
And you were saying earlier before we started the program about some of these organic, this greasy layer on the top of the oceans. Tell us a little bit about how that contributes to clouds.
Oh, yes. So as you probably know, there's lots of marine biology happening in the oceans. And so a byproduct of that, you get a layer of lipids and protein and greasy molecules that's floating along on top of the ocean. That's actually everywhere. And so when you have sea spray from basic wave motion, you get these greasy organics into the atmosphere. Those are very good at making clouds. They reduce the surface tension of the droplet and allow that droplet to grow a lot faster, or I should say with less available moisture. So those should help. So the science point would be if you have a biological bloom of algae, or if you have even one of these harmful algal blooms that you hear about, if we're correct, then that could give you clouds, you know, under those conditions. And so clouds whose lifetimes were longer, clouds with less moisture required, and so forth. So that was the correlation we were looking for.
And you do those experiments in your cloud chamber. You enter those sorts of molecules and you find which are the more effective at cloud formation under, again, the same supersaturation.
So those are measurements that we plan to do any minute now. We've been to the ocean and seen what's out there, but now we need to generate some biological compounds and do the cloud experiment back in the laboratory. That's still an open debate.
Okay, Sarah Brooks from Texas A&M, thank you so much for being here on Science Studio and explaining to us the entertaining and intellectual rigor of what you do. So thank you very much for being here.
And thank you very much for having me.
And certainly it's going to be a career changer for me, because I was thinking that in the Yucatan they have slash and burn farming. So I'm going to change my career, go down and lay on the beach and watch the clouds.
Well, I don't see the change. We'll be back next week. We just thank Dennis Wu this week for being the producer. We'll be back next week with another Science Studio. Bye-bye.
I'm Noemi Rojas with your Synapse Flash. Diana Schultz has been named new Chief Executive Officer for Kindred Hospital in El Paso. Kindred is a 62-bed facility that provides care to patients who require extended recovery time. Schultz comes to Kindred with more than 8 years of hospital CEO experience in Corpus Christi, Texas. Read more at mcasynapse.org. Support for Synapse comes from Kindred Hospital.